or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Especially in tight times, one of the last job categories that most employers are going to cut is sales. After all, sales is what brings in the bucks now. What are the trends in sales careers and in its nonprofit analog fundraising? Where is the hiring happening? How can you get hired without having been a salesperson before? Or if you have been a salesperson, what if you haven't regularly broken all sales records or even met your quota all the time? And how can you meet, let alone exceed, your sales quota while still being ethical? It can be tempting, for example, to withhold mentioning your product's weaknesses. Is it even realistic in today's society to expect that level of integrity? With me to answer such questions, or at least address them, is Wendy Connick. Wendy doesn't just write about sales careers. She has long been a salesperson. She, as a young person, she sold vacuum cleaners, the cliche. She sold vacuum cleaners door to door. Then she held a variety of sales jobs, from retail sales for an outdoor storage company to selling banking services to businesses for Wells Fargo. And now she's in charge of the sales career channel on About.com, a New York Times subsidiary until just a couple of weeks ago. And she is the chief content strategist for the National Association of Sales Professionals. Wendy Connick, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Glad to be here.
Good. Well, let me ask, start with a very sacrilegious question. Do we really need salespeople? I mean, we're in an era where, certainly with the internet, more information that's accurate can be provided on the internet for people to decide what product they need, what nut, what bolt, etc. And in general, companies I know are mainly, they hire salespeople because they want to convince, they want to use those salespeople to convince customers to buy their product rather than somebody else's product, even when it's not as good. They really are making their money when the salesperson is selling a product that doesn't sell itself, that isn't so great, that it doesn't sell itself, it needs an arm twister, subtle though they may be. Do we? Is the world really net better with salespeople or without them?
Yes, we definitely still need salespeople. And the reason I say that is because the salesperson's job, an ethical salesperson, is to almost act as an interpreter between the company and the customer. The salesperson's job is to present and explain the products to the customer. And, you know, kind of going back to what you said a minute ago, you know, even companies that have really stellar products still have salespeople. And that should tell you that, you know, just being the best on the market isn't good enough. You have to make sure your customers know why your product's the best.
Isn't that more of a marketing question? If I do have a product that is either better or cheaper or provide better service, I can provide that information essentially for free on the internet by describing that on my website, having the explanation can be, instead of, you know, if I'm a big company and I make refrigerators, and now let's say I have a sales force, I got 5,000 salespeople. They're not all going to be the best salesperson, but if I create a website or a video that explains that particular product, I only need my one best salesperson and my sales engineer to craft a magnificent video. Why do I need a sales force of 5,000 people, good, bad, and indifferent, who's really, I mean, it's not really just as an explainer. They really are. If you really are honest, I don't know about, I don't mean you, I mean, if we are honest, sales managers are looking for people who have the ability to get people to buy what they otherwise wouldn't, even when the product isn't good. Wouldn't we be better off with an honorable video that does the explaining, the interpreting that you said?
Well, the difference between marketing and sales is marketing is going out to the general public and sales is very one-on-one. So you can craft the best video in the world, but if it doesn't address the very specific needs that an individual prospect has, that video is not going to move them. Whereas a good salesperson can talk to the prospect, find out what those hot-button needs are, and then explain how the product works for them. Now, as far as the second part there is to, you know, whether the salesperson's just there to kind of twist the person's arm and, you know, get them to buy something that maybe isn't the best thing for them. Well, I mean, yeah, there's still plenty of salespeople out there who do that. But I'd have to say that the really top salespeople are the ones who don't act that way. They're the ones who look for prospects, for whom this product really is the best.
And I love, of course, I love that. And dear listeners, there's always a risk, especially on a Sunday, of me sounding like I'm a preacher, you know, being pontificating. But truly, you know, you want to be able to not only sleep at night, but tell your sons or daughters exactly what you do, how you do it, and why, how you earn your living. And I'd rather, I really, honestly, as I get older myself, I deeply believe that it is better to be a salesperson who sells less, even if you get fired from one or two jobs, and do what exactly what Wendy is saying, that is to sell, to explain the product, understand how it may or may not be appropriate for that customer's needs, not push them to close, and you will ultimately have lived a life better led. Father Nemko has just dispensed his sermon for the morning. Would you want to amplify or disagree with that at all?
No, I think you're right on. And, you know, kind of going to the flawed product thing, there's no such thing as a perfect product.
Sure.
Every product is going to have good things and bad things. And the trick in sales, in ethical sales, is to find the people for whom the good things are really, really important and the bad things about your product really don't matter to them.
Is it unethical? Am I being too unrealistic about the human condition to say that I really believe a good salesperson would point out his or her product's weaknesses as well as strengths? Or is that just, am I being delusional here?
No, I don't think you're being delusional. I think you're right. I think a really good salesperson, again, can find the people for whom those weaknesses are really not that important. You know, if
right.
you have, you know, just giving an example, if you have a really, really fast car that has a really lousy crash test rating,
mm-hmm.
you're going to look for people for whom a really cool, flashy, fast car is really important and who really don't care about the crash test rating. So even if you bring it up and you mention it, it's not going to cause a problem for them.
Sounds good to me. Okay, let's turn from that to, let's assume we do need salespeople, but it certainly used to, I'm interested in trends. I certainly know that when I was growing up, I remember Zig Ziglar 20 or 30 years ago, and he was the guru of sales training. And the message was, close early, close hard, listen well, come up, and then go in, you know, you give him the mail sales pitch. Do you want the red one or the blue one? You know, if I can deliver it by Wednesday, well, you say, do you have any objections? All that close early and close often stuff. That's changed, hasn't it? What is the current best one or two main approaches to selling today that today's salespeople are trained to use?
Today's sales is much less of a competition between the salesperson and the prospect, and it's more of a collaborative effort if you're doing it right.
Tell me more.
Now, in the 70s, a book came out called Consultative Selling,
mm-hmm.
and that book was pretty pivotal in shaping the way that we now sell today because, again, it was the salesperson presenting himself as a consultant, helping the prospect find exactly what they needed and then selling it to them.
Okay. Now, that's a really important point, and it makes a lot of sense. But that's in the 70s. In the year 2012, most of the people who I know will not take a call from a sales guy or a saleswoman. You know, consultation takes a lot of time. It takes building relationships. It's listening. It's talking. While being not a pest and being ethical, how does a salesperson today try to get the time from the customer to develop this consultative sales process?
A lot of it depends on what you're selling, actually. Usually the more expensive whatever you're selling is, the longer it's going to take to go through each sales cycle with each person, and the more time you're going to have to build that relationship, and the more important it is to hang on to that person. So if you're selling something small, like, you know, pencils, you're obviously not going to build a deep relationship with every customer. If you're selling, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, you're going to take a lot of time to build that relationship.
Yeah. So that leads us to where are the desirable opportunities. If I were your brother and I say, you know, I'm one of these people who, you know, I like to sell, but I'm interested in, I don't want a tough sell, you know. If I were opening and selling cigars today, I might have a hard time, where in the 80s it was easy. Where are the trends in terms of where are the opportunities, other than the obvious? Obviously, everybody knows green and healthcare. Beyond green and healthcare, or even within those niches, if I were your brother, what areas would you be telling me to investigate as for sales gigs?
Well, the baby boomers are still the bulge in the population, and the baby boomers are now moving into retirement. So anything that's going to be selling to retirees is going to be a big opportunity.
Like housing and disability insurance, that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Even things like leisure activities, you know, golf clubs,
right.
You know, timeshares, cruises,
right.
Anything like that. Even if you have the stomach for it, you know, things like funeral homes and selling coffins, you know, anything that's going to be aimed at that bulge in the population is going to be a big deal.
Interesting. Good point. Actually, I want to go back just a little bit. I'm interested. I love trends. So you said that there is a trend now to consultative selling. These are trends that started in the 70s. Are there any other trends in the selling profession or the sales career that you want to mention?
Absolutely. Building on the consultative selling approach, I think it was in the 80s or 90s this came out, was the value-added selling, which is pretty much what it sounds like. Instead of selling, focusing on price, which is, you know, a zero-sum game, you want to sell focused on value. And people have become very creative about adding value to their particular product that their competitors maybe don't have and selling on those points.
Give me an example.
Okay, I'll give you an example. Let's say a salesperson is in a very tight competitive market and a product is very similar to every one of their competitors. What they can offer is excellent customer service. They can promise they're always going to be available. They're always going to answer phone calls or return messages within, you know, 2 hours of a business day. They're always going to work as the customer's representative within the company to make sure everything goes smoothly on their end. That would be a value added.
Okay, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Wendy Connick. We're talking about careers in sales, ethical sales. I always love to underline. She is the About.com career sales career channel writer, which was a New York Times subsidiary until just a couple of weeks ago where they sold it off. And she is the chief content strategist for the National Association of Sales Professionals. What I have been hearing as the latest trend in sales is this, that you are not selling, you don't waste your time selling the features and benefits of your product. What you do is you try as quickly as possible to understand the customer's pain point. What is keeping them up at night? What is their problem? And seeing if you can, A, maybe send them an article or something that will help them solve their pain, even if it has nothing to do with your product. And then, if your product might be appropriate, explaining how your product specifically would solve their pain. Does that resonate with what you've been hearing?
Absolutely. That's kind of what I was talking about, finding those hot button issues that even your excellent video on your website can't find. That's what the salesperson is there to do.
Okay. So now let's talk about getting a sales gig. You know, we hear about a recovery, but really it is a jobless recovery. The unemployment rate of 7.8% is bizarrely understating the fact that, you know, if you're working for $4 an hour, minimum wage, $7.55 an hour part-time, you're counted as employed, even if you're making $150,000 a year before as an executive. But there's a heck of a lot of people who are working on crappy jobs, paying next to nothing, part-time, and a hell of a lot of unemployed people, and those who have been discouraged, and they have discouraged workers don't even count anymore. So sales is one of those careers that is often viewed, or it's analog fundraising. A lot of listeners to public radio love, you know, hate corporations, hate profit, hate, you know, all materialism. They love nonprofits. Well, fundraising is really selling. You're selling a nonprofit cause. So if I want to get into sales, and let's say, you know, I know that some salespeople make a lot of money. They make six figures, and it may not require a graduate degree or even a college degree. First of all, is it realistic for me to try to get at least a middle income earning sales job without having been a salesperson before?
It's possible. You may have to sort of pay your dues by spending a year or so working in a less than lucrative sales job just to prove you can do it. You have the basic skills, then move on to a better paying sales job. But I would say experience is definitely more important than education in the sales world. It's still perceived as a career where you're best learning on the job.
Do you have an intuition as to whether, if I was trying to aim at a six-figure sales job, would it be wiser for me to take a crappy $10 an hour retail sales job, or be a sales assistant, essentially an admin to a salesperson who is, you know, working for, let's say, Xerox, selling copiers or whatever?
Either one could work, honestly. Either one could work. It really depends on your what sort of sales job you're aiming for.
Okay. And now, you know, we have the generic career advice, which is, yeah, answer ads, but unless you've got a great track record, you know, you've broken all sales records, you know, these days an ad on Monster or on Craigslist or whatever is going to get, you know, dozens if not hundreds of applicants for any kind of a decent sales job. Like if I want to sell for Procter & Gamble or for Google or, you know, or Amazon, they're going to get hundreds of applications. if I have not, let's say I've had experience as a salesperson, but I have not broken all sales records, and maybe I, heaven forbid, I haven't even met my sales quota every quarter, am I really hopeless, or is there any advice you'd give to me as to how to trump that and land a good sales job?
Well, in a way, writing your resume is a sales skill because it's selling yourself. The same thing with when you go into that interview. You're selling yourself. So if you do very well on your resume and you do an excellent interview, your interviewer is going to see that you have the skills.
Yeah. What I would do, my way would be, it's like if my past won't sell me, I got to sell my future. Meaning this, let's say I was a crappy salesperson, or even I was never a salesperson. But let's say I really do believe in Becton Dickinson's medical supplies or whatever. I would go and I would research my butt off on Becton Dickinson's product lines and their competitors, Baxter Health, American Hospital Supply, and I would write a one-page paper that outlines the relative strengths and weaknesses of Becton Dickinson, and I would write a business plan. I would find some subset of their product line, and I would say, here's how I would sell, say, consumable hospital supplies, bandages and the like. Here's what I would do. Here's who I would call, and I would try to deflect deflect the attention from my past to the future. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I would add in there also write a example sales pitch that you would use to sell that particular product.
Excellent. Agree completely. Okay. Now, one of the great dilemmas that people have is, you know, do I insist on a base? For those of you who know, a base side, there are two kinds of commission jobs. There are two kinds of sales jobs. One is 100% commission, where you don't earn a dime unless you sell. But many others offer you a base, especially in the beginning of your employment, because they know that it takes time to build up those relationships so that you can make good money. So they may give you a $50,000 base, which then slowly disappears over a year to zero. Any advice about when you should be taking a 100% commission sales job and when you shouldn't?
Well, for one thing, a 100% commission sales job is actually easier to get, which kind of goes back to your previous question.
Sure, because there's no risk to the company.
Exactly. You know, they're not spending a dime unless you've already made the money. So they're much more likely to hire you if you don't have the experience or, you know, if you, to put it your way, haven't broken sales records in your past job.
Right.
So that can be a good way to get a foot in the door. Another thing is if you do well, commission-only jobs usually pay much better than a base plus commission job. So if you have a fair amount of confidence in your skills, you know, I would say go for a commission job. Really good salespeople almost always prefer a 100% commission job because they know they can sell and they know they're going to make a lot more money.
Right, and if you go and you ask for a bigger base, it implies you don't have the confidence or skills. Now, I recognize that there are some products or services that really do, you know, there's such a long sales cycle. Like you said, if it's a really expensive item, if I'm selling airplane leases, you know, I may not be able to close a deal for 4 or 5 months. It needs 19 approvals from various corporate and, you know, from people at the corporation. So I may need one, but if at all possible, especially if I'm trying to get a job that I'm not super qualified for, where I don't have a great track record, I would say I am confident enough. I will assume 100% of the risk. Just give me a reasonable territory and a reasonable commission schedule, and I will bust my butt and I will work at 100% commission. That can be a pretty compelling sales proposition.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So now, so many of the well-paying sales positions are technical, high-tech, biotech, industrial equipment. Is it realistic for a non-technical person to try to get hired in technical sales? Like, for example, I might figure, well, maybe the company will leave all the technicalities to a sales engineer who's going to be available to answer those technical questions. Or am I deluding myself? Do I really need to focus on non-technical products?
I would say no. It's definitely worth pursuing a technical sales position because, again, a lot of sales you can learn on the job. And I can guarantee you a salesperson who is not technical is going to learn better and do better than an engineer who doesn't know anything about sales and takes a sales job.
I totally agree. So much people who are content experts, technical experts, tend to bury the customer in technical specifications, which is exactly antithetical to what we were talking about earlier. Is the right approach to sales is understanding the pain points, the needs of the company, and then explaining in plain English how it will solve that problem. The techies are generally bad at that. I agree with you completely. Okay. Now, let's go to ethics. And this is a really tough issue. We broached it, of course, at the beginning of our talk, but I want to discuss it again, and maybe more thoughtfully. With so much competition and ever-ratcheted up sales quotas, and in a society when even presidential candidates in debates are lying and exaggerating, I would imagine it is ever tougher to resist those ethical temptations. You know, for example, to withhold the weaknesses of the product, but simply all kinds of deceptions. I had an interesting discussion last night with the people I went out to dinner with, and is how teachable is ethical behavior. We all know the right thing to do. We all know we should be fully disclosing. We all know we shouldn't exaggerate. We know we should underpromise and overdeliver. We know all that crap intellectually. Do you have an opinion, and I know you don't have the answer, but do you have an opinion about can behavioral ethics be taught where the people will act not in what's expedient for them, but what will truly cosmically be the just thing? And if so, how would Wendy Connick, who spent her life in sales in a variety of capacities, how would Wendy go about trying to get salespeople to behave more ethically?
I would say in this day and age, a salesperson who does not behave ethically is going to be shooting himself in the foot in the long run, because people, not only is there word of mouth now, and it used to be the salesperson could hope to just outrun word of mouth by going on to the next town or the next state or the next industry or whatever, but now those people are also going to be posting it on the Internet, and they're going to be talking about it on the Facebook pages about, you know, Joe Schmo who didn't tell them that the product was going to break down in 6 weeks or something like that. And then every time that salesperson looks for another job or is pursuing a major prospect, there's a good chance that that person's going to go in and Google his name and find all those horrible entries.
Yep. So, great. So there's the external thing. But is there, if you were the sales manager, let's say you were selling, I'll take the average situation. You're the sales manager of a company that is selling an okay product. It's not the best. It's not the cheapest. It's in the middle. And you were just hired, and you're the sales manager for this widget company, and you've got your 10 salespeople sitting in your first sales meeting, and you were trying to, despite the fact that the product doesn't have the biggest advantages in the world, it's an okay product, what would you say in that opening meeting that would attempt to try to get them to behave ethically, period?
Well, you know, that kind of goes back to what I said earlier. I tell those salespeople, here's what you do. You make a list of everything about the product, good and bad. You take those good things, and you look for the prospects for whom those good things are going to be the most important, where it's not going to matter to them that the negative qualities also exist. And those are the people you sell to, and then you can sell ethically because you can fully disclose the good and the bad, and they're going to be happy to buy it anyway.
That sounds pretty good to me. Okay. Yeah. For me, what my way I would add to that is this. I am a big believer in what's called the critical incident model of training, where you take the crunch time. Let's say I was selling this widget and product, and I know that, let's say, a customer is going to say, well, what about, and they mention the competitor's name of the product. What do you do in that situation? And literally we'll have them role play what they would do in that situation so that they are not in the moment, in the clinches, having to think on their feet. So I might role play it and say something like, you're absolutely right, they're a great company. I'll take something I happen to know a lot about. I know a lot about financial products. So Vanguard, for example, to me is the head and shoulders most ethical company in the world. But let's say I am the sales manager for Franklin Templeton, which has much higher fees. If I were the salesperson for Franklin Templeton, and I would, in that situation with the sales meeting, and let's say I'm role-playing out a situation where the customer says, well, why should I invest with you at Franklin Templeton when I could, at so much lower fees, invest in Vanguard? Here is what I think would be the honest ethical statement. I would say, you are absolutely right. Vanguard is one of the premier companies. They have one of the lowest fees. They have an excellent array of products. And indeed, if you told me, forget it, Marty, I'm going to invest in Vanguard, I would not roll my eyes. I would not pressure you. Here are the relative advantages that for some clients, they prefer Franklin Templeton. We have a China-only fund that only invests in China, whereas Vanguard doesn't. We do charge an extra percent per year. That is correct. But some people like the idea. Our annual reports and our disclosures tend to be more entertaining, frankly, more interesting. So many of us invest not just for money, but we enjoy the pleasure of the process of reading about how we're doing. And so take a look at our annual report, look at our quarterly statements. And now, having said that, I've given you the pros and cons. I honor your decision. Would that be an approach that you think would work?
Absolutely. That's a really good approach.
Okay. Let's turn many of our listeners, as I said earlier, to National Public Radio and public radio in general, really hate profit. They hate corporations. They hate that whole world. Certainly not all, but many do. The 99ers, so to speak. Corporations are the big evil. So many of them are very eager to work for the nonprofit sector. The nonprofit analog to salesperson is fundraiser. You're convincing people to part with their money to go for to fund a cause. Are there any differences between what works in selling for a company and essentially selling as a fundraiser for a nonprofit?
It's the same basic process. There are some differences between fundraising and for-profit selling. Usually make less money, but you also get more respect because, as you just said, many people see corporations as evil, and salespeople are considered basically, you know, con men.
Right.
So if you're fundraising, you get far more respect mm-hmm. from the people you're selling to.
Especially here in the Bay Area.
Absolutely.
No question. I would imagine in Cincinnati, if somebody said there were two people, one who says I'm fundraising for the Save the Whale Foundation, and the other says I'm selling for Procter & Gamble, I would imagine the Procter & Gamble salesperson would get more respect.
You know. Well, I don't know about that, but could be.
Yeah. I want to end with a little softball question. Think back now on the 27 minutes that you and I have been chatting here. And if there was one other thing that you wanted to tell our listeners that is important about sales careers, either in choosing one, making the most of one, landing the job in one, trends, what's the one thing you have not said that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would say the most important thing to have as a salesperson is self-confidence. Over and above, you know, being able to persuade people or being able to talk well or any of those things. Because if you're confident in yourself and you're confident in your product and you know your product is a good choice for the prospect, that will come across and that will enable you to sell to them ethically what is the best possible product to meet their needs.
I guess I have one more follow-up question. Many people don't want to be a salesperson because they're afraid of cold calling. They either feel it doesn't work or they feel they don't want to impose, they have fear of rejection. If somebody is, and I'll be honest, I have found that generally my clients who are cold call reluctant, it's very difficult to get them to embrace it enough to that they will do it for a career or even to use for landing a job. If some listeners out there who are listening to us now are attracted to the potential high income and lack of degree requirements of a sales career, but they are cold call reluctant, would you recommend that they consider a career in sales, and how might they mitigate their cold call reluctance sufficiently so they can be at least reasonably successful at it?
Well, cold calling is like a lot of other things that you're afraid of. The more you do it, the less scary and unpleasant it is, the better you get at it. There are things you can do to make cold calling easier. I was just reading a really excellent book called The Accidental Salesperson, in which the author recommends that before you even pick up the phone, you send a prospect one or two little articles related to their business in some way with a little note at the bottom saying that they might be interested in this. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually pick up the phone, you can say something like, I'm calling in regards to the article I sent Joe Smith. It's much easier to get in touch with the person, and you sort of have almost a pre-relationship with him.
It's a great point. I'm going to go to that well one more time. Any other tip for cold call reluctant people who might be interested in, or even introverted people who might nonetheless be interested in a sales career?
Well, I would add that the better you treat your customers, the more referrals they're going to send you and the less cold calling you have to do because you're getting all these warm referrals to you.
Yes. Makes great sense. I'll add one little comment here. If I were a cold call reluctant salesperson, what would help me be willing to pick up the phone is I'm going to be very concise. I'm going to be extremely respectful of the person's time. You know, everybody is not afraid to ask somebody on the street for directions to get to where they're going. That takes 30 seconds of the person's time. We feel that's a reasonable imposition. It's a part of being a decent human being on the planet to share, you know, to say, here's how you get to your destination. I like to think that a concise sales pitch, whether it be by email or phone, is the same thing. You're not asking any more of their time than that 30 seconds. If they then choose to spend more, they have made that discretionary choice. So that makes me feel like I'm not imposing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's critical that I let you get the last word. So I will give you one more. Is there one more thing that you want to share with our listeners before we say goodbye?
Yeah, I would say that, cold calling is something that everyone tends to hate. But like I said, the more you do it, the more you just kind of grit your teeth and get used to it, the easier it gets. Honestly, it does.
Well, it was actually quite easy interviewing you today, Wendy. It's been a pleasure having you as a guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for giving me part of your Sunday.
Oh, thanks for your time.
And Wendy Connick is indeed, she is the Chief Content Strategist for the National Association of Sales Professionals and also is the in charge of the Career Channel on About.com, which is a New York Times subsidiary until just a couple weeks ago. Anyway, now, my dear listeners, I want to turn to you as always. If you have a career problem, whether it be in sales, not in sales, nonprofit, for profit, you could be 60 years old and you still don't know what you want to be when you grow up, but you're not ready to play golf or do any of those. Somebody once called golf the golf course the staging area for the hereafter. If you're not ready for that and you would like to do something career-wise or avocationally, whether you're 16 or 61, I'd welcome your call. The phone number for what I call a 3-minute career makeover, what is your career pain? That's how my job is to try to help you be the aspirin for your career pain. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I'm also always very interested in people, two other areas that are kind of niches that I specialize in. One is self-employment. If you're either self-employed and trying to improve your business, or you think you have a self-employment idea you want to run by me, I would tell you whether I think it's good or not and why. And also leadership. I have a lot of clients who are executives in the for-profit and nonprofit sector. If you've got a question about how to become a more effective leader, I can usually be quite helpful with that as well. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I go to the phones, I do want to offer a little tip. And we are now entering the time when employers are hiring seasonal work for the Christmas season. And so I want to give you a little bit of, I want you to be ahead of the curve. So I dug up some research and I found this on Indeed.com. And these are the top 10 seasonal and part-time job titles that employers are hiring for. So you can, if you go to the aggregator job search websites like Indeed.com or Simply Hired or even Craigslist, and you search on these terms, these are the most likely. And it's a little depressing, but you know that these seasonal part-time jobs are not brain surgeon jobs. Sales associate, merchandise associate, that's the merchandiser, people who decorate the windows and the sales floors. Nurse, a lot of nurses take off for the Christmas holidays and they need nurses to fill in. You know, there used to be a nursing shortage, but there no longer is one. So one of the ways to break in many fields, not just in nursing, is to be willing to work on Christmas Day or New Year's Day or Thanksgiving Day. Because those jobs, they need somebody 24/7, 365. More seasonal and part-time titles that employers are hiring for in the top 10 list. Store team member, they call it. That can, you know, a variety of services. Customer service representative. Driver. Manager. Clerk. Cashier and material handler, which is the fancy word for warehouse person. And a few of the companies that have the most job listings for these seasonal and temporary jobs as listed on Indeed.com are Macy's, Target, FedEx, Mattel, Suburban Propane, interestingly, I don't know why, Party City, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, T-Mobile, and Tiffany's. Okay, phone number for a 3-minute career makeover, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, Marty. My name is Ronald. First, let me say I really enjoy your show, so thank you for doing a great show every week.
Thank you, Ronald.
And second, I've been working in nonprofit marketing and fundraising for the last 8 years, working at two leading environmental organizations, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about making my next step here, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts about transitioning either to the private sector or to working for myself. I found myself wanting more independence and more autonomy okay. terms of
well,
my career.
There the obvious one for self-employment clearly is that you become a consultant to small environmental nonprofits because it's an easier sell to say, I've been doing this for 8 years, working for two major environmental nonprofits. But the major nonprofits are unlikely to hire you, for starters, without consulting experience. But you go and you make a list of the small environmental nonprofits that you believe in and that you feel are pretty good. And if you, and what I do is the way I screen them is I visit their websites. And if I think their websites are crappy and that's emblematic of crappy marketing, I would write them, I always like to, have a target number so it could be 10 or 20, whatever doesn't turn your stomach. 10 or 20 nonprofits that are small that you think you could add value to their marketing and or fundraising efforts, and then write them a great letter, which gives away some of what you are going to suggest. Enough, it's a sample. I call it the Costco syndrome. You give them a free meatball in hopes they're going to buy 10 pounds worth. So you give them one or two suggestions for free, and you tell them that only is the tip of the iceberg, and would they like to have a chat with you to see if there's some compatibility, if they'd like you to come consult. That's the self-employment option. Before I get to the employed option, what's your reaction to that?
I think that's good advice.
Okay. On the company aspect, if you say you like the idea of working for a private company but you want more autonomy, again, you're probably wiser to work for small companies because the large companies, you need three permissions to blow your nose. So make a list of, again, 10 or 20 small environmental companies in which you are going to, and it is my judgment, and I know that some people, and I've said this before in the radio, have disagreed with me, but I really believe the era of alternative power, solar and wind, is over. The science is not there. The stock market price of the solar and wind index is down 95%, 96% from its all-time high when Obama got elected. I think the smart money is going to be on conservation. Companies that specialize in conservation.
Let me interrupt you there. It's something I happen to know quite a bit about. And while, yes, that is true about stock prices, that's just one chapter in a very long episode of what we're going to see happen with alternative energy. And while we're going through solar Armageddon, to be sure, prices for solar power have dropped.
I know.
Drastically in the last 10 years. And I think it's just the tip. So I don't know if I necessarily agree with you on that. I think there's a technology will continue to improve, and we'll see. Not to say that efficiency is the most important thing, you're right.
Yeah, so. We'll leave that for another day. But efficiency, right, conservation. So I'd be finding green companies that enable companies, especially business-to-business where the money is, that enable companies to save money, where it would be insulation materials or using effluents, using recycling ways to recycle some of their product that otherwise they would have thrown away, whatever it is. I'd make that my priority. Because
I have one last question for you.
Let me finish. Because even though everybody knows that the price of solar is going to come down somewhat, but the physics of it say that there is only so much it's going to come down, and because of the lack of availability of that amount of power, it's so diffuse that the amount of cost of storing it, transmitting it, every real expert knows that they will only be a bit player no matter how much, even if the costs come down dramatically because of the physical limitations and how diffuse. So again, my job is to tell you, it's one guy's opinion. I am, period. While I may have a PhD in evaluation of innovation, it doesn't mean I have all the answers. But I do, my job is to shepherd my listeners to the areas where I believe the growth is most certain, certainly over the next decade, and that really is in conservation and efficiency.
Sure. One last question before I let you go. Do you have some recommendations for how to best position myself for a transition from nonprofit to
absolutely
private sector?
It's about revenue. You need to, first of all, two things. First of all, you have to preempt the objection. So in interviews and in your cover letters, you need to say that although you've worked for nonprofits, that you are not the cliched, stereotypical guy who finds companies and corporations anathema. And you need to prove that by some anecdotes and how you have been revenue-oriented in your work for the nonprofit. You need to not sound like a typical environmental crunchy who hates corporations. So you need to preempt that objection, both in interviews and in your cover letters. Make sense?
Yep. contest. Thanks, Marty.
Okay, thanks for calling. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. If you have a question about your career, you are stuck, any problem, I like to, you know, the harder the problem, the happier I am. So whatever the career problem, the phone number here for what I call a three-minute career makeover or workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I go back to the phones, I read this in the New York Times, and I wanted to share this with you. I'm going to read you this section. It's really pretty good. It says, if you thought it has been tough to find good work over the last couple of years, just wait. The old problem was a bad economy. That kind of thing ends. But trends suggest we are headed for a what they call a global online arbitrage of opportunity. I'll explain it. With good workers in bad places, that is in low-income countries, able to snatch business away from people who live in better-performing environments. And if that indeed happens in large numbers, the competition will get really, really fierce for everyone. Between them, Odesk and Elance, the two major online purveyors of workers worldwide, claim to have more than 4 million coders, web designers, marketing professionals, and other workers who some even, for example, will spot pornography on Facebook at a rate of 4 for a penny. In the second quarter of 2012, Odesk says that its contractors worked over 8.5 million hours, a 70% increase over just 1 year earlier. The average freelancer at Elance expects to make 43% more money in 2013 as ever more employers come online. Taken together, the reports indicate much growth ahead in that online offshoring business and a lot of talented people looking for work wherever they can find it. Odesk, which surveyed 2,800 companies that used its service, found that 10% of the buyers, that is the workers, were college students here in America as well as worldwide, and 58% of the companies that are using these workers are no longer big corporations. 58% were self-described as startups. It says the habit of hiring online seems baked in. 64% of the respondents, these companies, said that at least half of their workforce would be online workers by 2015. And 94% of those companies predicted that in 10 years, most businesses would consist of online temps and physical full-time workers. The range of jobs being done, I'm still reading from the New York Times article here, the October 10th article. The range of jobs done online is increasing, too. Workers on Elance said the highest growing job categories in 2013 would be, yes, web programming, yes, mobile applications, but also design, marketing, and content writing. Odesk respondents were heavily in those categories, too, but also saw employment in customer service, admin work, and high-level technology development. Quote, as we move along, we see an increase in all categories of work, end quote, says Gary Swart, who's been a guest on this show, chief executive of Odesk. Quote, we now have lawyers, accountants, financial executives, even managers doing this online, part-time, worldwide work. The only work unlikely to go online is immediate physical work like plumbing, he said. But he added, even a plumber needs an accountant. What he doesn't need, apparently, is an accountant anywhere nearby. Some 30% of the United States citizens working on Odesk are working for overseas companies. Mr. Swart said an even greater number of overseas people are working for Americans, too. He said the online work is already changing how some governments think about labor. Last May, the government of Bangladesh decided to classify such online workers as, quote, an export-related commercial product free of taxes. So, and another interesting wrinkle from the Odesk survey, and I'm continuing to read from the New York Times, education alone probably won't help you get hired. Only 6% of the 2,800 companies responding rated schooling as a very important reason to hire someone. It was the lowest rated reason to hire someone. Work experience was first, followed by how other people rated the contractor, the pay, the portfolio of work, the references and scores on the skills test that Odesk offers online. In the future, I'm still reading, having a degree may be helpful, but having a reputation will be even better. One prediction I'm going to add here. It is my belief, it's a long shot prediction, but I believe that college degrees will become free in the next decade, as almost all content has become free. Yes, we may have to watch commercials, but just as MIT and other universities like Udacity and startups like Udacity are making courses, university-based and other courses, which may be more practical, available for free on the internet, I believe the next step, which will be it's a few years away, will be that college degrees will be free with the government acting as an aggregator. You will submit all the courses that you have taken to the government, who will give you, will see if you've met enough rigor, enough requirement, finished enough courses to get a bachelor's degree. That's going to be the breakthrough idea, an offshoot of the amazing advances of bandwidth so that we can watch video, we can do interactions easily online. One little bit weird prediction, but I believe it's true. Anyway, let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, good morning, Marty. Thanks for all you do. You've been a great a light in the den of inequity. Your guest Wendy is excellent, and I've even used your 30-day here's what I do in my first 30 days in a couple of interviews. We've spoke before. I've been in the printing business, printing sales for 25 years. I have my own company, and it's just drying up. Printing is going to China and Mexico.
Yep.
I looked into solar, and you're right, solar is dead.
Right.
I have an unbelievable reputation and great contacts, and it's just been a struggle to find the next thing. I'm far from being done. I've got three more boys to get through college,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know. I wished I could just get the magic pill some traction. There's a couple of openings that were open at big companies like Apple, and I walked down that road and only to find that the job had gone to someone that was in place as a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So I contacted Robert Half International through the Creative Services, an arm under Robert Half International, and got on the list there, and they've been supportive.
I'm going to interrupt you. The two words you said so far that are most that seem to offer the most hope is the word great contacts. I understand that your great contacts are in the printing industry, so they're not going to hire you in the printing industry. But great contacts are people who believe that you are smart, a hard worker, a nice guy, ethical, whatever it is, and people know people. Every single person, even though I'm a career counselor, I know thousands of people in thousands of different fields. Those great contacts you have are your goal. They are your bridge to your next career outside of the print industry, even though they are in the print industry. What I would encourage you to do is to make a list of all those great contacts and even sub-great contracts that are okay contacts that like you, and write one or two words next to each one of their names, like email and coffee. In other words, email, invite them to coffee. Or party, invite them to a party at your house. Or go hiking with them. Choose an individualized approach for how you're going to get together with them, and then do that, and tell them, you know, I really appreciate how supportive you've been for me over the years. As you well know, the print industry is drying up. It's either the work is going in-house because the technology is so great people can do it in-house, or it's going to Mexico or China. I need to have an exit. I need a job out. My best skills are A, B, and C. Might you know somebody I should talk with? And even better, might you be willing to set up a three-way meeting of introduction? Because those three-way meetings, where that person introduces you to the person who might potentially hire you, that is much more powerful than, say, a reference, say, yeah, you should talk to John Jones. Does that make sense?
So pursue your contacts and okay.
In an individualized way, ideally asking them to say, you know, I appreciate you liking my skills A, B, and C. I need to move out of this industry. Is there some is there somebody that you could set up a three-way coffee or go out to drink together or a teleconference to introduce me to that person? That's the most potent technique you can use for making the bridge. Does that make sense?
And sales is sales. Printing sales is sales. And your comments on cold calling, cold calling is charades without the Chardonnay. It's easy. It's something that I find easy to do.
Good.
So it's just a matter of finding the right product.
Then you need to also, if you're looking for, what you're trying to do is sell, keep your same sales, your same function, that is sales. What you need to have is a soundbite, a 5-second or 10-second soundbite that explains, even to your network, what makes you a great salesperson. You could say, for example, my sales quota in this industry was X dollars. I've exceeded it, 18 quarters in a row, whatever the truth is. Having a one-sentence soundbite that proves that not only you've been a salesperson, but that you really have been a good and ethical salesperson, that can help your network motivate them to go the extra mile and not just say, oh, yeah, you should talk to Joe Jones, but indeed be proud to introduce you to Joe Jones because they say, well, this guy really is a great salesperson. And Joe Jones, if he's selling soybean processing or solar or whatever, will be more likely to offer you the job if introduced by somebody in your network. Does that make sense?
Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi. Is this me?
It is you.
Great. So I'm not looking for a makeover exactly, but I have a question kind of in general.
Sure.
Which is how much to factor in age. Mm-hmm. In terms of taking the risk of moving from one job and company to another.
It depends.
Like I'm getting close to 60, mm-hmm. and been a good company, good job for 6 years. In some, it might be good for my career to move again, mm-hmm. but I'm feeling like maybe it's too risky to then, if that didn't work, like to be 60 and on the market again.
Well, the wise choice, obviously, first of all, you don't quit until you find another job. And then when you are interviewing, you are picking your target employers to be ones where you're likely to be excited and successful. And you, during the interview process, you vet them as well as they vet you. You're going to ask them, what kind of work do you do?
Training management.
Okay. And so you're going to ask them about their management and about... If you sense that they have the kind of problems that you could solve, that should give you additional courage to make the transition. I don't want you to let fear dominate you. Yes, I like to say that age is one strike against you, but it's not three. There are many people who have had one strike against you who hit home runs. And so if you do your due diligence and you find the kind of organizations that you really think you would likely thrive, whether it be the kind of product or service, and then in the interview process you check them out and you get a sense of whether these are the kind of management problems you'd solve well. And then when they offer you the job, this is my favorite trick. It's not really a trick, that's the wrong word, but favorite strategy. You say, I'm delighted that you offered me the job. Can I come in to kind of discuss terms with you and as well just get a feel for my work environment? And then when you go in there, not only do you negotiate terms, which is great, but you get a feel for the vibes in the place where you're going to be working. You hang out in the break room. You talk to people. You ask questions like, gee, I've been offered a job here. What should I know about working at this place that might not appear in the official employee handbook? Those kind of things reduce your risk to an acceptable level. You wouldn't be calling me if you were satisfied in your current job. You feel you want to get out of there. And I think the blueprint I've just laid out is a way to reduce your risk to an acceptable level. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'm confident that I could find another job, through a process like that. I guess, in addition to that, my larger question is, when you move, when you take another job, there's a certain amount of risk that, well, that won't work out, and you'll end up on the job market again. And so then, maybe without a job at that point, how much of a factor is age.
Of course. If you're unemployed and you're older, then you got two strikes against you. But
yeah.
What I would encourage, you know, the fact that you're worried that much about losing the next job implies that either you think your skills are not what they should be, your attitude, your health, whatever. If the goddess were looking down upon you, would the goddess say that if you do the right vetting and you do find an employer that seems right, how good are the odds you would succeed? Or would the goddess say that, no, you probably are going to get fired in a few months?
No, the odds are good that I would succeed. I'm just risk-averse and have been laid off a couple times in my life.
Well, then use lessons of the... Layoffs don't occur at random. Usually they occur, you know, because you have been either haven't worked hard enough or smart enough, or it's been the wrong job, or you've been emotionally high maintenance, or you haven't gotten along with people, or whatever it is.
I would disagree with you. I've also not been laid off many times, and a lot of people in this world have been laid off through no fault of their own.
Certainly, that's true. There sometimes it's seniority, whatever. I'm well aware, but there is no downside to you looking inward at the layoffs, and because you're worried, you're risk averse. I want to maximize your chances of not getting laid off again. So it certainly can't hurt for you to look inward and ask yourself: Are there any lessons that I need to learn moving forward about this to increase my chances of not getting laid off again? Does that make sense? Okay. And the other thing is, you know, the first 30 days on your job are critical. It's a cliche, but it is true. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. So when you do get hired, another way to ensure you don't get fired is to make sure you set up meetings, even if it's 15-minute coffees or whatever, with every key stakeholder. Both your bosses, your peers, and people who are below you in the hierarchy, and say, I really am eager to do well here. What should I know that doesn't appear in the employee handbook? What are some of the things that are most critical? How can I talk to your boss? How can I ensure my success? Do the practicing when you get home. If there's some reading you need to do, instead of maybe normally you'd want to hang out and watch TV, this is the time to do the reading so you get up to speed. So all of those things can greatly increase your chances of being successful in the next job. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more 3-Minute Career Makeovers on you, my dear callers. And 3 successful engineers, not 1 college degree. They'll tell us how they did it and how you or someone you love might also. Plus, their stories embed a lot of lessons for anyone who would want into a career without the standard credentials. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.